Well, welcome to the first Queensland Gardening Hour. Sitting around the table, we've got Jerry Colby-Williams.
Good morning.
And Noel Burdett.
Good morning.
And me, Lisa Jane Stockwell, or LJ. So I thought we might start out this morning with why we're doing this.
Yeah, well, it's of course there's a big reason for it, because we want to keep getting that garden information out to all the avid gardeners out there in southeast Queensland. That would, Jerry.
Well, I've also got a particular interest in the subtropics, because I think they're generally underrepresented or misrepresented in mainstream gardening media. So what we're doing is something which is relevant to people in our area, which they can't find elsewhere.
Beautiful. True. Now, boys, we were just talking before about managing the work of the garden. And, you know, some people might say that, oh, it's very difficult to get out in the garden. You know, how do I manage my back? How do I deal with, you know, the pain of ageing or muscles? So what do you think about that?
Well, I suppose I'd like to say none of us are getting younger. I'd like to think we are, but of course we're all getting older, and we've been gardening most of our lives. I'm pretty sure Jerry would agree with me on that one.
Jerry's been gardening all his life. I think he popped out of the womb and went out and dug a hole, didn't he?
And of course, you know, we didn't feel the heavy lifting, you know, say 10 years ago, even 5 years ago. But of course, as we are getting older these days, we are realising that, you know, there are limitations to what we can do. We tend to limit our time out in the garden. We tend to choose our jobs a little bit more, I suppose.
So tell me about choosing the jobs.
Well, I suppose lifting things and trying to reduce the amount of times you do have to lift one bag of something over and over again. So you do, you know, for instance, my back garden is quite away from my driveway, so I have to carry a large bag of potting mix, for instance, down to the back garden. So I have to carry that downstairs and around through doorways and all that sort of stuff and through gates. So I'll either use my wheelbarrow to do that if it's available, because it's usually full of weeds, or I'll carry it. But I'll make sure that my travelling is worthwhile, so I'm not having to, you know, go back and forth and back and forth, or I'll carry things in the right way.
You need multiple wheelbarrows.
I do, but then I need multiple people to help me.
Yeah, wouldn't that be good? Wouldn't it be great to have staff in the garden? I dream of that. What about you, Jerry? How do you manage the heat and the workload?
Well, it's interesting that you mention the heat first, but most gardeners tend to injure their backs through repetitive strain at a much earlier age, and I injured my back when I was 21. So I've always been careful about how I pace myself. I always vary the types of work that I do. And although it's not very masculine to get down on a kneeling pad to do certain things.
No one's watching, Jerry.
I do find that if I do have to lean over something, I'm weeding a garden bed, not bending is one of the ways of reducing stress on my back. As Noel said, I always have a little trolley, and I use that to move heavy sacks around the garden, so I'll avoid carrying things over my shoulder, as I used to do when I was a kid. And I'm very careful that I have access points to my property. So, for example, I can have a truck of up to 4 cubic metres of mulch delivered onto a tarpaulin in my driveway to reduce carting. I have all my footpaths allow a wheelbarrow to take material from one place to another.
What width would that have to be then?
I like to have a footpath 1.75 to 2 metres wide. 1.25 is the standard width, which allows two people to walk through a garden side by side. So that's the minimum sort of width. And the other things that I do is I slowly build up in the morning. I warm up. I don't go straight out and dig a garden bed. And if I have a series of garden beds that need to be dug, I'll do one a day. And I've found that with the 6 vegetable beds that I have in my food garden, that if I do one bed on one day, I'll be tired in the evening. But the second day, I won't be quite so tired. By day 3, I could do 2 beds and I don't need a break. So you actually need to remember that when you do vary jobs, that eases strain on different parts of your body. But if you've got the opportunity to ease your muscles in, we use so many different muscles as gardeners that they can't all be fighting fit and ready for action. So this idea of doing one bed each day is a way of pacing yourself, and you don't You build up your stamina by the end of it.
That's right. I was thinking you're building gardening fitness in a way,
yeah,
aren't you?
Yeah, you do.
And I was also thinking when you were talking about the width of the garden walkways, a broad walkway looks better too, like in a design sense, wouldn't you think?
It does, but I mean...
What do you think, Noel?
From my perspective, it removes the amount of space you've got for gardening.
Ah.
It does, and it can relate, of course, to the size of garden that you do have. Of course, things need to look in proportion as well. So looking at the pathways in Jerry's garden, for instance, they look in proportion to the size yard that he actually has.
Yes.
I actually have slightly wider areas in certain spaces, but then others I have the minimal gap of about 1.2. I've never really played a lot of close attention to that. I've just done what comes naturally in my areas, and I've tried to utilize the topography because my garden is actually in different layers, and that's just how the land is.
I didn't know you didn't have a drive into the backyard.
No,
so
I
everything
don't.
Has got to be wheelbarrowed in.
Everything has to be wheelbarrowed in, and there was a time where I could get like several meters of mulch and gravel out the front or soil, and then I have to wheelbarrow it right into the backyard. So I did that many, many times, and I've been thinking about doing it lately, and something keeps putting me off. I'm not too sure what it is, but something keeps putting me off.
All right, boys, let's move on to one of the first questions. Jerry, did you get an interesting question from your open day?
Well, I got heaps of different questions, but a couple of things that I really liked was one person here that sent in a photograph of something which looks rather like a wizened capsicum.
Mm-hmm.
Sean says, I work at a special school here in Brisbane. We have a kitchen garden program as part of the curriculum. I was given what were believed to be gooseberry seeds. Nothing seems to happen, and they reuse the soil for growing. And when I came back up from holidays, I noticed this rather large bush at the end of the veggie patch. What is it? Is it a weed? And I looked at this thing quite closely, and I think they've actually got tomatillo, which is it's a plant which is not very commonly grown, but it has tomato-like fruit. It comes from the Americas. You grow it in the warm seasons, and I've never succeeded with it because when I tried, it was eaten by so many different types of caterpillars, and beetles ate the leaves, that I had to cut it back three times. And then when it did grow and bloomed and started to produce seed, we had a hailstorm which destroyed it. So tomatillo,
Sean, is this Sean, is it?
It's a great idea,
yeah.
But I think you can save the seed from that and re-sow the seed that has a lantern-like, paper-like seed capsule, and there's a berry inside with lots of different seeds which are quite easy to remove and re-sow. And it's a nice little thing. You can make sauces from it.
Yeah, what would you use it for?
Sauces, basically. It's a sweet tart sort of thing. It's not really a tomato, but it's tomato-like.
Does it stay green?
No, the fruit inside ripen from green to a nice orange colour, so they look quite appealing to the eye.
Oh,
it's a little bush, about a metre high, just a little bit more
than
that.
And you use the fruit inside, do you?
Yes, that's what you do. Mm-hmm. So I think that's Sean has actually got something which was given to him as a gooseberry, but it was a tomatillo, and it was waiting to see the light to actually germinate, because if you bury the seed, they don't germinate very freely. So it's just been sitting there in the soil waiting for somebody to expose it, and they've got a vegetable.
And then they must have had just the right weather to get it up.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah.
What about you, Noel?
I've got a question. Yes, one came recently the other day, actually, and this is from Naomi, and her question asks, "Hi, Noel, I'm needing some help. Still learning how to maintain my garden. I'm needing to give my roses a good prune. And when is the best time in our climate? And I have quite a few shrubs that need some loving." So she's taken on a new garden that she's not too sure of these plants.
Yeah.
And my suggestion to her was that you can prune your roses any time from now. But, you know, roses in southeast Queensland don't go into a true dormancy period like they do in the southern states. They'll just completely spring back to life as soon as you prune them. So I suppose the more traditional times of the year is June and July for pruning roses in Australia. So she can prune her roses quite safely at this time of the year, as long as, of course, she gives them a good feed to reward that prune. So a good bit of blood and bone, a little bit of sulfate of potash, and possibly a bit of dolomite or gypsum for the calcium content. And then, of course, do any weeding that requires, and she'll see that those roses will just spring back to life almost immediately. Like I said, they don't really go into a state of dormancy here in southeast Queensland, just continue to grow.
And do you have lots of roses in your garden?
I have a few roses in my garden.
How do they go?
They go well. I actually don't have any of the modern roses. I only have a few of the heritage roses in my garden. And right now, my Monstera tiliaria is looking absolutely gorgeous. I have five of them growing underneath, right at the base of an ironbark tree. And of course, that's not an area where I would tell people to grow roses in general, but heritage roses are very adaptable and incredibly strong. These roses actually are remnants from before 2011, and they went right under the floods of 4 metres of water in that time, and they've lived to tell the tale. They're incredibly strong. I never spray them, I never do anything special to them. I fertilise them but once a year, and that's about it. They never have to be worried about, I don't have to worry about insect problems with them or diseases, ever.
Noel, you must have just the right spot.
No.
What is it?
It's not the right spot. It's the choice of the plant. It's the choice of those particular roses, the Monstera tiliaria. They are incredibly tough. And this is where the strength is forgotten about with a lot of the modern day roses in today. They are breeding them for their vibrant colours, their large flowers. They're often forgetting about the fragrances, but also their strength, their vitality is something that's being lost as well. So the new roses are very open or very prone to diseases.
How interesting. So heritage ones, hey?
Yeah, and these are growing on their own roots as well.
Perfect. Let's move on to giving a call to
Chelsea.
Chelsea.
Yeah, we're going to be speaking to Chelsea Van Ryn from the Trevellyn Lifestyle Centre in Brassel, or North Ipswich. Chelsea, tell us a little bit about the history of the nursery and how long have you been part of the nursery there?
So about 16 years ago, my parents, who were landscapers at the time, bought the garden centre, and it sort of developed over those years. I started working there very soon afterwards. I'd just finished university and I sort of started working there. My passion for gardening hadn't started yet. It was more of a job to do. But now it's, live, love, live it. Just can't get enough of it. So it's just developed into, I will say, it's a garden centre. And one of the joys about owning your own small garden centre is that you don't have to sometimes follow every other trend out there. So, for instance, Mum loves camellias and azaleas and ignoras. So at this time of year, the nursery is just looking divine. Heaps of colour, heaps of flowers everywhere. And we don't have to stock the same things that everyone else does. It just enables us to be a bit different. And we've also got giftware, of course, and all of that type of stuff. And one of the big things as well for me that I've bought into the nursery is aromatherapy. So we sell all Perfect Potion essential oils. So, yeah.
And of course,
it's small but good.
Yeah, and of course, the aromatherapy does tie in very nicely, of course, because they're all derived from plant materials. So it's another way of actually enlightening the senses when it comes to plants and when it comes to enjoying a garden as well, especially the perfume garden. So do you have much in the way of perfume plants in the garden there?
Oh, yeah. Actually, one of my all-time favourite plants is just in bloom at the it's budding up. It's the Rondalisa, and it's all coming into flower at the nursery now. So we've got lots of those ones. And we just got one of our first delivery of roses in. And the gentleman that we get our roses from, he knows that I don't like roses unless they have a smell. So and just some of them that he's got given us this year, you just want to stick your head inside of them. They are just divine. So, yeah, lots of nice scented things and nice scented foliage. We've just got all new scented geraniums, and there were some smells there that I didn't even know you could get in scented geraniums. There was cinnamon was one of them. So it's great.
Chelsea, it's lovely hearing you saying that you can personalise a garden centre, because I think this is a really important thing about independent traders, because we live in a world where we are immersed, we're saturated with hardware stores which just pump certain things onto the market, so they depersonalise their centres. Is this something which customers respond to?
I think so. We truly try to stock. Like, granted, if a new plant comes out, we will try to get them in. And it's our ability to be honest with people as well. So, like, we love camellias and azaleas. So we can honestly say that these plants are great. We've grown them. We've grown them in this area. It's not just trying to push them out the door. You can hear our love and passion for them. And so when you ask us a question, we can honestly take from our experiences what we've done with it. And, like, when new plants get released on the market as well, and we've trialled them and say, look, we honestly don't grow them or have them in the shop because they don't grow well in Ipswich or they don't grow well here, because we've personalised it. It's not, we don't have to follow, we don't have to bring 100 plants in and try to sell them to our customers, doesn't matter where you live or, you know, anything like that. And so because we have our own gardens at home, this is what we do, it's not just a job for us that we have to sort of earn income from. This is our life as well. So that passion comes through when you're explaining it to people.
And Chelsea, I heard you say before that your mum loves gardening too. So is it a family business?
Yeah, so she's there most of the time and me. So at the moment it's just the two of us.
Fantastic. And it must be interesting, like you're saying, that the conditions, the growing conditions at Ipswich, you know, that you really understand them. And I'm just thinking how different they must be from, say, where Jerry's gardening over on the coast.
Yes, definitely. So where we are as well, we in Ipswich, it's a really weird climatic zone. So to a certain extent, on top of the hill, you won't get frost. But you drive down the bottom of that street to a lull and they'll get frost in that area. So people can get sort of different plants, you know, while you say drive around the streets in your area and have a look what plants they grow. For some people, it doesn't work out that way. So we've kind of got a family as well that live in all different areas of Ipswich and the Brisbane Valley. So we can say, look, we know this person. And strangely enough, they are growing that plant out there and that's not getting affected by frost or, you know, the heat or that type of thing.
So a key aspect of your business is actually alerting gardeners to the different microclimates that exist in the area in a way that you wouldn't get in a major store.
Yeah. And just letting them know as well and be amazed at how many people come in and you say to them, you know, like, look, that might be a lovely plant, but you live out Eskway and you're probably going to get frost out where you are. And they're like, oh, I don't know. And because I've never thought about it before, that they've never contemplated how really cold it does get. They get a frost and things. So certain plants are going to look shabby during the wintertime compared to they do during summer. So it's also making them aware of their own situations too.
Chelsea, one of the things I do like about independent nurseries is you have the opportunity to really put your own personalised stamp on the visual aspect of the business. And one of the things that stood out for me while visiting the nursery was how beautiful it does resemble an actual garden. And this is one of the nicest aspects of walking through a nursery, which you will not really see at any other business. So was this something that you deliberately went out to actually explore to make it look like a garden, so when visitors came to visit the nursery and buy plants, they would get that experience?
Yes, definitely. It was one of my mother's big things when we first bought the nursery. She actually ripped up all of the plant stands and made them so they weren't all in lines.
Wow.
And she's kind of, and she just said, I do not, she would refuse. And we don't have, you know, when you walk somewhere, it's like natives are in this area. Mm. And so when people come in as well, they say, well, where are your natives? And I said, well, natives grow in the shade, they grow in the sun. Some like a bit more, some like this, some are small growing, some are big growing. I can't just stock all my natives in one area. That's impossible to do. And so we wanted that people as well were enticed to walk around, they were enticed to linger. So when they go home, they go out in their yard and they want to linger and they want to walk around. So, yeah, it was specially designed to make it look like a garden. And as well as that, with our ornaments, we make a point, like, we try not to get, you know, 30 of one thing. It's about how you display it at your home. So you're not going to walk in and find all your ornaments lined up in a row. Our ornaments are placed in amongst the plants, so you get a visual of, that would look like that in my garden. Oh, I love that with green around it. That looks great.
That's the wonderful way of showing things off and really placing ideas and images in people's minds. Chelsea, it's been great having you part of our first podcast forever, and I think it's wonderful that you could be a part of it. So thank you so much for sharing with us your time and your thoughts and your passion with us. Now, can you tell us a little bit how to find you and where you are?
So we're on, it's called the Ipswich Warrego Connection Road. and it's in Brussels, and it's number 77. And basically, if you're travelling along the Warrego Highway, you take the Pine Mountain Road exit and travel towards Ipswich, and we're about 2 minutes past that.
You also have a Facebook page called Trevallon Lifestyle Centre, and of course, you're one of the very few nurseries left around the Ipswich region, so well done, congratulations, and thank you so much for coming on board today.
Thank you very much for asking me, it's a pure pleasure. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Thanks, Chelsea. Well, I know both you boys are completely passionate gardeners, and I always think it's interesting to hear about where that's come from. So I wanted to ask you, how did you get involved in gardening? Do you want to kick us off, Noel or Jerry? Yeah?
Well, for me, I was drafted into gardening. I had no idea that I had any skill at all, but my grandmother obviously saw something in me when she was in her late 70s.
Perhaps she just saw free labour, Jerry.
Possibly. But she had arthritis in her hands, and she was unable to do a lot of heavy pruning. The secateur work caused too much pain. So she got me out pruning a blackberry in London. And of course, in London, blackberries are actually quite enjoyable things to grow. They're not an environmental threat as they are here in Australia. So I did it the first year under her instruction, and then I became her apprentice. And so the next year, she asked me to point to where I should prune the blackberry bush. And the third year, she just sat down on a stool, had a cup of tea, and watched me do it, and only intervened if I did something wrong.
So this was about age?
Four.
Right.
I was four, and by the age of seven, I had migrated to being in charge of the raspberry patch, because I obviously had a knack for pruning and soft fruit, and it basically grew from there. But I've never really been obsessed with gardening until I got into my teens and I had to make a decision between plants or animals. I've always liked nature, you see, and my family told me I'd never make any money out of gardening, so there's no point following that. And the same thing, I liked art, and they said, no, you'll never make a career out of art, so I abandoned that, and I tried to become a vet, but I didn't have the brain for the maths and the physics. Gardening had enough maths and physics for my brain to be able to cope with, and so I ended up becoming a professional gardener through that. So I chose plants after I couldn't make a career out of animals.
Aha. Uh-huh. And so you did some training, obviously?
Yes, I did. I mean, I did a sort of family apprenticeship, I would say, under all of my grandparents and my extended family. They all were very different types of gardeners. So you had food growers, you had orchardists. Some were into romantic gardens, others were into totally controlled, formal, middle-class gardening, and others were into estate gardens. So it was a very wide range of things that I learnt. But I studied with the Royal Horticultural Society, and then after that I went to Kew Gardens, and that was when I got my professional training, and I did a course in management as well. So those were the things that I did. Fruit, flowers, herbs and vegetables with the RHS, and formal training with Botanic Gardens and Botanic Gardens management through Kew.
And then you thought, I must go to Australia and try the subtropics.
Well, Kew actually had a scholarship at the end of the year. Third year students could apply for a botanical scholarship to certain parts of the planet where they wanted to enhance their connections, and Western Australia was one of the places that was on the list, their hit list. And when I was looking around at different parts of the world that I could go to, the West Australian wildflowers really hooked me in. I liked the style, the look and the country that they grew in. And so I applied and I was successful. And that was how the connection with Australia was developed. I never wanted to leave once I actually set foot in WA.
And what about you, Noel? Well, what was your beginning gardening story?
Mine began at around the age of five, actually. And I suspect, I didn't realise at the time, but it was from my grandmother, just like Jerry. And I suspect there was more to it than just teaching me about gardening. I suspect because my brother had just been born, because we're all 5 years apart. And I suspect that my grandmother took me outside to possibly give my mum a little bit of peace and to allow us to look after my younger baby brother at the time. But she took me outside in the garden. I remember very vividly standing in front of a bed of calendulas. And of course, to this day, calendulas are very close to my heart. So calendulas were the first plant I was ever taught to pick the seeds from and enjoy the smell of their foliage and also to grow the young plants. So she showed me how to pick the seeds and how to sow the seeds and how to find all the new ones. And that time there was no such thing as mulch on a garden bed. It was just clean soil, immaculately clean. I think my father always used to do things like that. But of course, that always stayed with me in my mind. And as I grew a bit older, I ventured into growing things like nasturtiums, of course, and Bellis perennis. And I remember getting very angry one year we planted the Bellis perennis, the English daisies, and they didn't grow very big. They flowered quite small in comparison to the calendulas that I remember. I remember getting quite angry and telling my mum to rip them out because they were just ridiculously small. But of course, that was just me not understanding. But of course, that stayed with me all of my life, and I grew passion fruits from seed when I was a kid and used to take them in to mum and put them on the windowsill. And of course, having a Sri Lankan background, we'd use a lot of spices and herbs in our cooking. So I would then be encouraged to grow things such as lemongrass and chilies. So by a few years later, by about, you know, 8, 9, 10, I was growing things like chilies and lemongrass out in our back garden in Victoria. Of course, then this is how amazing climate change has been. You could only grow those things in the summer, and then come the autumn, that'd be it. They wouldn't even be around for the wintertime. It'd be too cold in Victoria. So I'd be growing those sorts of things, and curry leaves were completely unheard of.
Oh yeah,
you couldn't grow curry leaves in Victoria.
Gee, I think lemongrass would have been unheard of in the 70s, wouldn't it?
And lemongrass was quite unconventional to be grown in the back garden, but for some reason my mum got some down from her sister's place here in Brisbane at the time, and we grew it in our back garden, but only over the summer period. So that was it.
Amazing,
and then, of course,
isn't it?
You go to school and you always had that liking of gardening. But, of course, it wasn't cool in the 70s to tell your friends that you really preferred to go gardening as opposed to riding the motorbikes.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, so I sort of kept that to myself a little bit. And a similar thing to Jerry. Of course, I was told that, you know, continuing to find a path in horticulture or gardening. There was nothing like that at school. When I was at school, there was no one teaching any child about gardening then, which I wish they were. I really wish they had.
Yeah.
But so, of course, all the signs as a child were telling me, don't pursue that career. Don't pursue that career. So I went off. And a bit like Jerry, on the artistic side of things, you know, I wanted to be a set designer, I wanted to be an actor, an artist, all those sorts of things. And of course, all those things were squashed, you know, because your parents told you, no, you've got to go into something that would go make you a lot more money. Eventually, though, you move away from life, from those sorts of things, and you come back to them. You know,
to the things that
interest
you.
In your mid to late teens, yeah. You have other things in life, so you come back.
When Noel mentioned that he wasn't encouraged in gardening, it reminded me that when I actually confessed to my headmaster that I wanted to become a gardener, he told me I had to leave the school. He wanted to expel me because it was just such a humiliating thing for the school's reputation to have somebody end up as a gardener.
It's very interesting because when back in the late 70s when they were doing work experience for students in that time, they just brought in work experience.
Yes, I remember that, yep.
And one of the first things I said I wanted to do was gardening. I actually wrote down their gardening. And, of course, my teacher said to me at the time, don't be ridiculous. There's no such thing like that. No one's going to be able to give you work experience in gardening. You have to do it in your backyard, blah, blah, blah. And then I thought, oh, goodness, I mean, that really squashed that. And, of course, very intimidating, you know, for a child to be told that at school by a teacher, which yeah. You look up to. And, of course, then I said, well, what about set designing? Theatre, and that even got more of a shock of a look.
That's worse.
But eventually, as life went by, I ended up doing a variety of different work, actually, and all to dealing with people in one way or another. But it eventually took me into floristry, and that's when I went and studied floristry in Victoria. And of course, the floristry aspect just appealed to me visually because of all the flower content and all the flowers you can physically get your hands on, the things that you could never grow in your garden, like bells of Ireland and Alstroemerias and all those things in Victoria. So Floristry was my major stepping stone into the horticultural industry. And I was very surprised to find when I ended up working in the horticultural industry that many of the flowers that I dealt with and I knew by name, knew my vision, that none of these so-called horticulturists knew what they were. And I was absolutely blown away. And I thought, oh, I've got something over them. Because essentially, I don't have any formal qualifications in horticulture. I'm not afraid to hide that whatsoever. And yet, when I ended up working in retail horticulture, I ended up knowing more than the so-called qualified horticulturalists that were employed there. So they would come to me quite on a regular basis and say, Noel, what's this? Can you identify this? What's the problem with this? And I thought, goodness me, I'm not even classified as a horticulturalist at the time. So, of course, that sort of...
It gave you confidence.
It gave me more confidence. Yeah, and, of course, I just pursued that industry, and this is where I am today. So I'm very proud and privileged. I feel very privileged to be part of this industry. Yeah. And to be able to share my passion with what I do, to other people and to help them as well.
Before we move on, Lisa Jane Stockwell, producer and garden lover, why are you interested in gardening?
Yes.
I have a fantasy garden. It's not the reality, as you can see. My garden doesn't happen. And, I can sort of see it in my mind's eye. I know how I want it to be, but I just don't have the time or the back to do it. Isn't it the same? That's why before, when we were talking about having staff, that would be ideal. If I could just get a couple of strong young blokes in here and say, right, clear that out, we're going to plant. Well, Noel was suggesting planting one of the spots under the tree with salvias, and I can just see it working, and, it'd be lovely to have big food gardens out there. And,
yeah. Do you know what? You know the sort of cottage gardener I am.
So I guess it's, the fantasy of your garden. If you've got the energy to make it happen, it can bring huge benefits, can't it? I mean, to your health and to your, people talk about the emotional benefits of gardening.
Absolutely, Ajay. I don't really think you can even measure it because you don't really see the benefits until you've got something in.
Well, you were saying yesterday you got completely lost in the garden and, you were just focused and felt great.
It's one of the things that keeps driving you as a gardener. You just need to put one thing in and see that it stays alive. And then, of course, that will drive you to plant something else. And, of course, when you've got teenage children around your feet, I think that's the great opportunity to dig a hole.
Yeah, good point. That teenager's still asleep, though. All right, let's talk about jobs to do. So what... at the moment we're dealing with, a very extended, you'd almost call it summer still, wouldn't you? I mean, here we are in nearly the end of May.
It's still warm. It is still warm. I am seeing a major difference in seasons in my garden, though. Mm-hmm. I'm actually clearing out lots of areas in my garden and creating new areas in my garden that weren't there before, because I'm actually planning on planting a lot of self-sowing annuals in this particular area, and this is deliberate for me because it's an area I actually came to the realization that I don't actually have a lot of direct sun in my garden because of the surrounding trees on the entire edge of the garden, and of course, because of that, making the best use of the sun patches in my garden is the best thing. So, I love my annuals. I love my cosmos. Nasturtiums, linarias, all those sorts of things.
So is this the time of year to be doing jobs like that, to be clearing areas of your garden out if you need to?
It's not that bad. It's really not that hot. It might seem warm, but, 22, 23 is divine weather to actually be gardening anyway.
I wouldn't say it was summer-like at all. I mean, we're heading from autumn into winter. Mm. And for me, the prompts that I see in my garden every day is the bees. I've got two different species of native stingless bee in my garden. One will only go out foraging at 17 degrees and the other one likes it to be 19 or 20. So I've actually got living thermometers in the garden. And judging by when the one which likes the warmer weather, the tropical bee, when that starts to have a quiet start or a late start to the day, that's a cue for sowing things that like cooler weather.
So at 19 degrees, no matter what time of day it is, that's when they head off.
Well, I mean, if it's cloudy as well, there's other things that limit them. So if you have a really cloudy day or a wet day, they won't move out if it's actually raining. So, even in summertime, you'll find there'll be days where they won't go out to work.
So what jobs would you be doing at the moment, Jerry?
Well, prompted by my bees, what I like to do at the end of the wet season is to test the pH of my soil. And I do that every year, but I don't necessarily have to do any action after it, because most of the work is generally replenishing nutrients. And if you get the pH right, generally between 6.5 and 7, so slightly acidic to alkaline, then any manures, fertilizers, composts that you add to improve the soil and fertility become chemically available. That's the connection between pH and feeding. At the end of the summer rains, when most of those nutrients that are mobile have been leached through the topsoil deeper down, I like to replenish them, and the pH test is the first thing that I do. This year, I had to lime my lawn because it was actually 100 times more acidic than is ideal. Ooh. It was about 5.5 on the pH scale. So I've put dolomite on to add calcium and magnesium, which sweetens the soil. After that, I can fertilise, but I wait about 3 weeks before I add anything to turf following that treatment. With the garden beds, it's digging the soil, removing summer crops. I've got corn, which is finishing, and a few other things which have set seed. So they come out, go into the compost heap. Old compost comes out into the bed, dig that in. And the first things that I sow are beans, because they're very quick, quite easy to grow. And 6 weeks ago, I put in my first winter bean crop. And these don't succeed in warmer weather. They need the night to be between about 14 and 16 degrees before the flowers self-pollinate and produce the pods. Mm-hmm. So that first sowing is now coming to the end of its season. I've picked it two or three times, and this week I put more beans in, so there's a succession of beans in the garden, and I can have maybe another two crops during the cool weather, so yeah. I can get four crops in the cool season.
I was going to ask you what you do with all your beans, but that brings us to what's in Jerry's jars.
Oh, right, okay. Well,
can we start with beans?
We can talk about beans. But if I do get beans in my garden, what I tend to do with them is I eat them fresh, uh-huh, as best as possible, because beans really do need to be eaten fresh. I mean, the stuff you get in the supermarkets are generally quite rubbery.
Oh, right. And
any surplus, I freeze. And I don't freeze a lot of my crops, because freezing means you're using electricity,
yes,
to keep them in a reasonable condition. But when you have a premium crop like beans or something like corn, then I freeze it. And this week was the end of my corn crop, so I cut all the kernels off the cobs, put enough into a little freezer bag so it will serve three people, mm-hmm, for one meal, and that's the unit that I store them in, and I freeze those straight away. With beans, I wash them, top and tail them, mm, and chop them up so that they're ready to go into the saucepan. And I blanch them in boiling water for a minute just before I put them into the fridge. And that means they keep their colour while they freeze. They can go a bit grey if you don't blanch them before you freeze them.
And how but handy when you've got to do a quick meal just to grab one of those little bags.
Oh, look, they're cooked. They're cooked in under 3 minutes after that process. But The trick is you put them in boiling water for a minute, then you put them under cold running water for a minute to cool them quickly, then I put them into a tea towel, get the moisture off, and then they go into freezer bags, again in proportions to suit three people for one meal.
Well, there you go. That's how you deal with your bean glut. All good. Now, what is in your jars today, Jerry?
It's nothing particularly exciting.
Oh, come on. He says, putting a beautiful glistening red
ago,
jar of piri piri chili jam in the middle of the table.
3 years ago, a gardener called Noel Burdett gave me the piri piri chili, which is one of the Sri Lankan staple chilies.
I remember.
And it's been fruiting ever since.
Oh, has it? And what's its heat rating?
Well, now you're opening a whole can of worms.
Go on, let's get into
it. The heat in a chili is something that we register as heat, even though it's not actually a temperature thing. It sets off the temperature sensors in your mouth as if you are putting something hot in your mouth. And there's a Scoville heat measurement, a scale, and each heat unit is a Scoville heat unit. And so the coolest chili that I have in my garden is a yellow one, which is called Siam Gold.
Oh, that's the one we got. Beautiful.
That's about 3,500 to 4,000. Yeah. So it's pleasant.
Yep.
Then there's the Cayenne chili, which is a long red curly chili, which is quite popular in supermarkets. You'll find those sold. That's 30,000 to 50,000 heat units. Then there's Knowles Piri Piri, which comes in at 50,000 to 100,000, which is sort of middle of the range. For most Europeans, that's hot. For my senses, that is hot.
How do you feel about that, Noel?
You can go well above that.
Yeah, well, I love hot, but then again, I've been brought up with it.
Yeah,
so
right.
My taste buds are quite acclimatised
okay.
to slightly hotter chilies.
All right. And then what's next?
Well, the next one up is, I'd say that the bird's eye is another popular one. Again, you can buy these little red chilies, and they look quite innocent, but their heat is 100 to 225,000 heat units.
I have a little story with the bird's eye, because when I came up from Melbourne, my grandmother taught me to cook from the age of eight in Sri Lankan food. And I came up and I was asked, would I like to make the dinner? And of course, my uncle, my aunt, my five cousins, my mum and my dad and my grandmother and all that were there. And I thought, oh yeah, I feel a bit proud. So I went off and picked stuff. And my uncle said, out in his backyard, which was in West End, he said, he's got the spices and things that I need. So he had the chilies, the lemongrass, the curry leaves, the pandan, all that sort of stuff. And I thought to myself, you know, these chilies are so tiny. I thought, I need to put a bit extra. I was used to using chilies this tall, this big in Victoria.
I picked about
20 of the bird's eye chilies and put them into a curry. And my goodness gracious, did everyone suffer that night? And I thought, I wish I had put the toilet paper into the freezer.
Oh.
but seriously, that was a very, very hot curry. But yes, I'll never forget it. But then when I planted it in my own garden, my young son Thomas at the time had the neighbour around, and I said to him, and I was really surprised and very proud of him, I said, you never to ever touch those chilies and put them into your mouth. I said, they look like little carrots, but they're not meant to be eaten like that. And he was telling the neighbour's son this one day before I went out open day for the open gardens. He said, you know, you're not supposed to eat those because they might look like carrots, but they're very, very hot. And Thomas was about five. And I felt very proud of him telling the little boy that.
He was a good little trainee gardener.
I know.
So in Jerry's jars, I've just got to tell you, Jerry is busily preparing it's a beautiful little snack. He's got a sesame wheat bicky. They're yummy, aren't they, Jerry? They're fab.
Yeah.
Salty.
Lovely.
Nice. Then he's got a goodly slab of some, what is that?
I think this is brie.
Yum, yum. And onto it, he's put a dollop of piri piri chili jam. And tell us about the recipe.
Well, the recipe is based on 150 grams of chilies.
Let's go, Noel.
And
he's talking.
You'll have crunches in the background.
Yeah, here we go.
I also put garlic in. So 150 grams of chili. There's a whole bulb of garlic. You put in, I think it was 500 millilitres of cider vinegar and a kilo of white sugar. You warm the vinegar, dissolve the sugar into it, put the garlic and chili into a blender and pulverize it into a paste, put it into the bubbling cider vinegar. You cook it for 10 minutes and then it sets. And one of the ways that you can actually encourage it to set is some chilies, if their chilies are red, then they have enough pectin to set very thoroughly. And this is set like a thick gel.
Mm.
But if you use yellow chilies, then you have to add pectin. And this is just one of those things I found, because the recipe that I use assumes red chilies. It doesn't mention that others have different pectin content, a bit like citrus. Some citrus, you actually need to add pectin to get a decent thickening.
The Maya lemon, for instance, has very little pectin, if any, so you have to add pectin.
But what about bagging up the seeds in a little bit of muslin and chucking them in?
It doesn't
do
it.
It
has a very low pectin count.
Ah, interesting.
So you'd use your true lemon, such as your Lisbon or Eureka. Because the bush lemon was the old one, has a very high pectin count, so it helps to set it all, yeah.
Beautiful, Jerry. It's so tasty. It's sweet, and I can taste the vinegar in it. It's got a sharpness to it. It goes really well with cheese, doesn't it? I want to hoe in, but I'm worried about the crunch on the microphone.
You've always been scared about eating my suggested foods, haven't you?
I'm a bit worried that Jerry is a bit experimental and that one day we're just going to be found dead under the table. And they'll go, it was all in the cause of entertainment.
Science. But,
As long as he hasn't picked it up from the side of the road before.
Bit of roadkill.
I think everything will be rather safe.
To celebrate our first podcast, I made us it's a little Italian rustic apple cake. I just cut the apples up really into nice little pieces. They're uncooked and then made up a basic batter with vanilla essence in it, and so that the apples remain suspended in the batter, so it's not running. What do you think?
Delicious.
Yum yum.
Very nice. I'm not into cupcakes.
Yeah.
I'll be honest with you.
Oh, it's supposed to be a cake.
Not at all. I'm not into cupcakes, but this is just delicious.
It was supposed to be cooked as a big cake. It'd probably be nicer if you were doing dessert for everyone with a big cake with some custard on the side.
Very
or something.
Moist, LJ.
Yummy.
This is what I was trying to explain was the Adam and Eve pudding.
That's it, is it?
Which my mother used to make.
Did she know it was an Italian recipe?
I don't think so. No, she would have got it from the Housewives Institute.
Yeah.
It was an old recipe from the Housewives Institute.
It's not complex, is it? The trick is to get the apples to cook, though, so they've got to be small enough that they, you know, just sort of bake in the
it's
cake.
Delicious.
Yeah.
I've been cooking as well. Funny enough, we've all been having a bit of a cook-off.
What have you got?
Well, there's been a glut of capsicums on the market lately.
There has not.
A lot
what
of
have
capsicums.
You done?
So I've made, my favourite is capsicum relish. I just adore capsicum relish. So I've brought a jar for each of you to take home and try.
Wonderful.
And it's based on red capsicums. But I actually put a green capsicum in there for a little bit of extra tartness.
Because Did you bake them first?
No. You cook them as they are, but with a little bit of vinegar in there, with the sugar, salt and pepper and
spices.
I put a bit of extra spices in there as well. And then there is one red chilli in there, which actually seems to have imparted quite well. I just love this on freshly toasted sourdough. It's a little bit of a self-indulgence on that one, but it's also nice to have with meat in sandwiches, all those sorts of things. So
yum.
Yeah, so what you do when you have a glut or something on the market, buy it because it's cheap and, you know, don't think about how many can you fit in the cupboard or the fridge. Go home and cook with it immediately like I did. I think I bought about 24.
Yeah.
The hardest part is chopping them all up.
Well, I similarly got a carton of red capsicums the other day because they were $5 for the whole carton.
Yes.
And I thought, right, I know what I'm going to do. I just chucked them all in the oven, baked them till they were blistered, covered them over with Glad wrap and waited till the skins then just rub off after a while when they cool down that way, and then just chuck them in with some vinegar, and we've been having them on our salad sandwiches.
Or you can bottle them with olive oil and peppercorns.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, funny you should mention about the capsicums up in North Queensland, many of the farmers can't sell them. They've actually been dumping them
and
giving them to cows to eat because they cannot actually sell their capsicums on the market. There's been too many of them.
So let's get into the plant of the week, Noel. What have you got this week?
Well, of course, I've got lots of different things in my garden that I had to choose from. But I thought for today I would pick something just that little bit different, things that you don't see around. And this is actually coming to the end of its cycle in my garden. This is a thing called Persicaria microphylla, red dragon. And Persicarias aren't commonly seen. This is not a very good image of it, but I mean, it can certainly get you a nicer
I'm just taking
one.
A photo of
but
Noel with it.
Jerry's probably familiar with Persicarias. They used to be known as polygonums. And one of the members of this family is also Vietnamese mint.
Oh, yes. Yeah, right. The leaf does look similar.
Yeah, and this one doesn't have a scent. It isn't used in a culinary sense. It's just a very pretty foliaged perennial plant in the garden. Now, the reason I say it's coming to the end, because this, believe it or not, this has faded since I picked it. And it's actually quite dark central eye zone, and the leaves are normally a burgundy colour. But so as it comes towards the end of its growth cycle in the garden, it starts to fade, flower, and then go herbaceous. It goes deciduous in the wintertime for me.
So this is a winter herbaceous perennial? Mm,
it is. It's one of the very few true ones that actually that grow quite beautifully here in southeast Queensland. And, of course, you know me and cottage garden plants and perennials. So have had this for several years now. I've also got a lime green form of it as well, which has different flowering habits. There's a lot of wild persicaria that grow as roadside weeds in ditches and in moist corners of Brisbane. And you'll see them with their little flower heads on right now. They flower throughout the autumn, late summer, autumn into winter. Mm. They look very pretty, and they're actually very important for butterflies and day-flying moths, so they get into these little flowers and have a lot of fun. So they're a very pretty plant, but unfortunately, these seem to escape cultivation. So it's not something that you'll find, for instance, in a nursery. You won't be able to walk in and find them. Maybe in a southern-style nursery, we'll find them available because they're more open to the herbaceous perennials down there. I think there's a lot to be learnt yet about them up here. A lot of people need to accept their habit as to how they grow. Jerry, you've probably grown lots of these things in the Sydney Botanic Gardens.
I've always had a love-hate relationship with that group of plants in my life, because in Britain, a lot of the common ones are really aggressive weeds and they have deep tap roots, so they're difficult to get out of crazy paving.
That's right.
So I remember battling them in people's gardens.
Yeah.
But the cultivated forms are really very attractive and quite simple to grow. If you've got good drainage, they like moisture, but they like good drainage as well.
They do. They don't like to be constantly wet. You know, there's nearly 150 species of them.
Oh, my goodness.
They're quite diverse as well. And there are some that are just incredible to see because they have the most amazing hot pink tassel-like flowers. And this one has little heads of creamy white flowers on them. They all look different, and you wouldn't know that they're members of the same family unless, you know, you were right into gardening and you were collecting that genus of plants.
If you were going to position those in a border, you'd have those towards the front, because while they like dappled shade, they don't like to be blasted with sun, and they don't like to be smothered by other things.
They like
space, don't they?
They don't like to be smothered, but they also grow to about, you know, 50 centimetres tall and about 70 centimetres wide. This one does anyway. And I have it in moist soil, as you say. That's relatively well drained. It's in a cooler part of the garden, down the lowest part of my garden, so it does actually take its herbaceous nature to the full extent, which is something I quite like.
Because and do they escape from your garden?
Never, 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 never. It stays in the one spot, has been there for years, and then in the springtime it erupts in a beautiful array of brand new deep burgundy foliage, which is just an absolutely wonderful thing to see. But this is just one of those more unusual plants. And I like to encourage people to grow these unusual perennials when they can, if they can find them, which is the hardest part. Because I think it really opens up the doors and the windows to different areas of gardening. It really, I think, entrances me when I'm growing plants like this, because I get to see something like this here in southeast Queensland, as opposed to having to travel interstate or to a cooler climate to experience them.
So if somebody wants to grow this, what's the best chance of finding it?
Well, the best chance of finding it would be through mail order at this time. We'll probably wait until spring. They would send it through. They could actually send it through mail order while it's dormant through the cooler months of the year. They need to know what they're looking for. So it's Persicaria microphylla red dragon. There are several forms. And when people look at them on the internet, for instance, very, very beautiful and very eye-catching to the eye. I just wish people were more open to the use of these plants, because they don't conform to, you know, the look of many other garden plants that we're used to. They're softer. You can't trim them to a perfect shape. They're meant to be lacy. They're meant to be a bit more free form.
Mm-hmm.
So people need to be more open to plants of this nature.
So now, Noel, people could find this on your Facebook page they wanted to have a look.
They will find this on my Facebook page. I haven't posted it as yet, but
you're about to. And tell us again what that is.
So that's called Persicaria Microphylla Red Dragon.
And they can find your Facebook page at
Noel Burdett Growing Gardeners.
When we were talking about growing beans a little bit earlier on, a couple of other cool climate herbs that I always grow in winter. In fact, chervil and watercress do not like warm weather. Last year I thought I'd get a good crop of both of them by sowing them in the middle of May, and nothing came up until we hit winter in July. So I recommend that chervil is something that people grow. It's a bit like the plant you're just talking about there, Noel. It's familiar. When you see chervil, people think, oh, I know that plant, because it looks a bit like a type of parsley. When they smell it, it reminds them a little bit about fennel, because it has an aniseed-like flavour to the leaves. But it is such a simple thing to grow. It only grows in winter, and it's delicious.
I love chervil, and it's, you know, it's the French chef's choice of herbs.
Is it? What would you use it with?
Lots of French food. Fish, anything you want.
Salads.
Like Jerry said, anything you want to impart a slight aniseed flavour to. Wonderful in sauces.
Is it a herb that you'd see when you're shopping in the greengrocers?
Not very often.
No. It's available now widely in all the stores in the garden centres who actually carry herbs. It's very fine and lacy. It's a very, very pretty plant.
And low growing. That plants only get to about 30 centimetres high. Mm-hmm. They flower and set seed, so you can save the seed and grow them again the following year. I tend to let them drop their seed and let them find a place in the garden where they want to live. And then they just come back year after year. But you can buy seed for chervil from Green Harvest, and that's where I get my watercress seed from as well. And the difference between sowing chervil and watercress is that chervil likes to be slightly covered. You slightly cover the seed and keep it damp. Watercress likes to be kept damp, but the seed do better if they can see the sun. So you scatter them over a nicely dug bed. We put a bit of compost in, rake it level, and then you just cover the seed over it and keep it moist, and it'll come up in the cool weather. Why would you grow it? Well, I think a lot of these things take us back to early experiences, and childhood for me was watercress and Marmite sandwiches, which would now be, of course, Vegemite sandwiches. But it has a lovely, fresh, peppery flavour, which goes extremely well in that type of a sandwich. But it also makes a wonderful garnish, just like chervil. I recommend you try it and experiment with it. And it's something that you can only grow in the cool seasons, so I think people should be growing it now, and you can get the seed from Green Harvest as well.
Absolutely. If you've got bog gardens or even around a pond that's damp, nasturtium, this is actually a nasturtium species, mm-hmm. and they love the moisture, and they're very pretty. I've seen it growing in alongside creeks and things like that as well. One thing about the chervil I wanted to point out, it's a member of a very, very large family, isn't it, Jerry?
That's right.
It's a member of the Umbellifera family, and of course that includes carrots as well, and coriander. Yeah. And everyone knows what coriander is, and you know what family it is when they start to flower. It gets these lovely little lacy heads.
And hence why you're saying that they look familiar.
Yes. People recognise it, but they can't exactly place it because it's not quite this and it's not quite that. But it's just part of a very large group of really important herbs.
Very much so. And as you say, this is the time to grow it. And this is also the time to grow your coriander. It's the perfect time of the year.
It's the only time of the year. Coriander's so hard to grow, don't you think?
No, not at all. No.
Not really.
If ever I have a gap in a garden bed and I can't make my mind up what I'm going to do, I just get some coriander seed and throw it down there and let it come up. And again, I let it sow itself. You can save the seed quite easily. I find that it grows all year round in my garden.
So you've got no shortage of it when you're cooking?
I suspect.
No, I do have shortages because I like making pesto
out
of it, and that chews up a lot of it.
Yeah, it does, doesn't it?
I have a suspicion that most people who say that coriander is difficult to grow, that they've only tried growing it in the warm weather.
Yeah,
and they
buy
the plants and they stick them in, and the plant goes, oh my gosh, as I'm far too hot, I'll bolt to seed and it dies.
So now's the time to put
now's
it in.
Now is the time to get the longevity of it. And like I've said to so many people, if you love coriander, don't just plant one plant. Plant an entire patch of it, and then harvest from different plants, but only harvest from the outside leaves.
Yep.
Because if you take the inside, the plant's going to think it's under threat, and off it bolts to seed.
I see. Okay, it's like parsley. Just bring it in from the outside.
Absolutely.
Now, boyos, let's do another question each.
Mm-hmm. I've got a Facebook question from Susie on the Sunshine Coast saying, good morning, Jerry. I'm heading off to Nepal and I'd like to take over some seed. Most people will be familiar with the fact that Nepal's had an awful earthquake, which has completely disrupted everyday life and society. So I can understand her wanting to do this, but my advice to Susie is that whenever you take seed across a national boundary, you have to have a phytosanitary certificate issued from your government saying that the seed is clean and healthy. Now, at the moment, when a country is suffering from a massive earthquake and systems are not working, the last thing you want to do is to introduce a disease inadvertently, because their agriculture department is not going to be able to respond to it. And these things regularly occur. So what I've said to her is that she should go to Nepal, and if she's able to buy locally sourced seed and she's being able to transport herself around the country, she can take the seed with her. It's much better to get local seed anyway, because that will be the sort of varieties which local people are eating and growing. So much better than taking a gamble over here and taking over something which is unsuited to the soils or the climates. Plus, you don't take the risk of importing diseases into a country that's already suffering enough. Now, once she's there, one of the quickest ways a person can feed themselves is with seed. I mean, things like lentils and beans can be soaked in water, and then they can be cooked and eaten. If you've got a surplus of that type of seed, you can sow them and sprout them and eat the sprouts. Sprouts up until the point when they have their first pair of true leaves. Sprouts of any vegetable are highly nutritionally dense. In fact, they're more nutritious at that stage than probably at any other stage in their life. So microgreens is a word which people are familiar with. Growing things, eating them young as thickly sown seeds is one of the quickest ways you can feed people. And so I reckon that she needs to go and sort out what seed she wants when she gets to Nepal.
And what about you, Noel? Have you got a question there?
I do, actually. This is from David. He says, I have a golden duranto and I want to remove it as it takes up so much of my time to maintain. Can you suggest an alternative for this that won't grow so quickly and keep me on my toes? I need it to only get to over a metre tall and remain evergreen. It also needs to be drought hay, as we are on tank water.
All right, well, for the non-gardeners among us, what is a golden duranto?
A golden duranto is what has been commonly sold for the past 25 years as a thing called Sheena's Gold.
Oh, yes, I do
know. It became highly popular with both the councils and also a lot of people because it was easy to grow. It was unafflicted by pests or diseases. It grew quickly. But unfortunately, the payoff for something that grows quickly is that it needs constant maintenance. Mm. This is something that was never actually highlighted on the plant tags when you bought them. It did not say that once mature, you must prune once a week to keep looking good. So, of course, people are only now realising this problem when it comes to very fast-growing plants. I like to suggest, and I always have liked to suggest, plants that grow a little bit slower. They may not get to the exact height that you want within a year or 2 years, but that's the thing. They're easier to care for, they're less troubled. So one of my choices that I would suggest to David is to choose an Acmina, which is a dwarf form of lily pili, Acmina Allen Magic. I believe it to be one of the very best plants to have been released on the market for hedging over the past 20 years, and yet it seems to have gone under the radar. People gravitated away from it because it wasn't a fast-growing plant. It didn't jump out of the ground.
Yeah.
I've got them in my own garden and I could not be happier with them. They are unbelievable. They are very, very tough and they really have need no watering once they are established. They are not afflicted by the same problems as any other lily pilly. So they don't get psyllid problems. They don't get any form of mites. They don't get caterpillars chewing on the leaves. For some reason, it's completely left alone. And at this time of the year, all the new growth comes out beautiful tan and cherry and cream coloured foliage. It's not growing for flowers whatsoever. It's only growing for its foliage. But David, if you're only looking for a small hedge to get to just over a metre, this would definitely be my choice. If I had to choose another one, it would be Moraya minimin, which would be a dwarf form of Moraya. And it's
I'm
delightful.
Glad you mentioned that, because that is something which doesn't get mentioned often enough.
No.
And it is one of the most exquisite small shrubs that you could have.
It is incredibly beautiful. I believe it to be the Southeast Queensland's or subtropical answer to Buxus. Both of them can be, but the minimum in particular, because it resembles Buxus from a distance with its deep green foliage, and it actually flowers with little heads of white perfumed blooms, but a well-trimmed hedge of that is just a delight to see.
One of the fun things I had with a minimin hedge at a friend of ours was that it actually is quite fluid and wobbly. So you can actually move the hedge, and it's like a little slinky. It's very interactive. I just can't keep my hands off them as I see them. It's a beautiful little thing to have in the garden.
It's interesting how a lot of people are just coerced into thinking that they must choose fast-growing plants for use in their gardens. And it's a shame that more horticulturalists and nurseries out there aren't promoting the use of these slightly slower-growing plants. But the end results are 10 times better, always.
Beautiful. Well, listen, on that point, we'll wrap it up. This has been our first podcast for Queensland Gardening Hour, but we'd love to know what you think and what you'd like to hear on our podcast. We'll make another one when Jerry gets back from his trip that he's about to head off on for a couple of weeks. But if you're listening to this, you obviously found your way to queenslandgardeninghour.com.au, and we'd love you to get in touch. So why don't you go to the contact form and send us a message. Maybe you could ask a question for Noel or for Jerry, or tell us what you've been growing, or what you'd love to hear in our podcasts.
One thing that we would invite everybody to do is to tell us about gardening events that are coming up so that we can connect the gardening community to what's on. That's a very important thing. We'll also be interested in some of your recipes. I've actually got some homework for you, LJ, which has come in from one of our listeners. This is a beetroot apple chutney. So there you go. You can report back to us about that next time we meet.
What do I have to do with my homework? Just eat it?
What does it go best with? And would you make it yourself? I've got the recipe, which I will post.
All right. I've already got an idea. I'll save that for next time.
And of course, we want the podcast to be people driven. So of course, all those questions people can send in, and of course, the information that you say. I mean, that's what helps to drive this program. So.
And please tell your friends too. So we're starting out small, but we're hoping that Queensland Gardening Hour will be a really big community effort.
Yeah,
it's all about subtropical gardening with people that garden in the subtropics.
Beautiful. We'll see you next time.